Well, first, Jamie, I think it's just beautiful to hear about what it looked like on the ground in Portland as well. And we were aware the whole time in Washington that these protests were happening all over the country and, of course, all over the world. And numbers started to filter in throughout the day, 250,000 in Chicago, 500,000 in New York. I mean, you know, it's just staggering. I organized a number of buses from Rutgers, and so I knew for weeks that this would be huge. But it really was off the charts to actually be on the ground with, I mean, just hundreds of thousands of people, most of whom you can tell from their signs and from the way they were participating. I had never been to a march before. I'd never been to a protest before. And people came with generations of their family and extended networks, and people who had never been or don't even perhaps to this day consider themselves as particularly political showed up. If we could have gotten more buses at Rutgers, we would have filled up many more buses. It seems, from what I could tell and from what I was told, every bus from the Mississippi River to the Atlantic Ocean was leased out over the course of the last few weeks, and it was impossible to lease any more buses. It could have actually been larger, I think, but you couldn't move. I've been at mass demonstrations for decades. I've never literally, physically not been able to move for almost an hour and a half, stuck in place. And yet, because the feel and the sentiment of solidarity, of love, of wanting to oppose everything that is out there that Trump brings with him was so dominant, what could have been, frankly, a very physically dangerous situation became one of, you know, discomfort, of course. It's not comfortable to not be able to physically move at all for an hour and a half. But people were together, and people got to know each other, and people chanted, and people talked, and just kind of shared stories. And it was beautiful. It was absolutely magnificent. And it's, the numbers alone are an important thing to dwell on for a moment, because it is unprecedented and it bodes well for the fights that we have ahead.
Here in Oregon, there were at least strike against our boastful sexual predator president. And what did you see in D.C., and what is the significance of this uprising against sexual assault?
Well, absolutely, for sure. The pink sort of pussy hats were everywhere. I'm not, I was wearing a black cap from my union with big red fists and a pencil in it that said, an injury to one is an injury to all. And folks on air with us were wearing those as well. But I think there was definitely an undercurrent, an overcurrent throughout of hostility to the sheer fact that somebody could really, you know, it permeated things, but it was not just one of many messages, but it was one that sort of punctuated the day, that we will not go back. We will not be treated as pieces of meat. You are not going to denigrate women in this way. And I think it really, we could probably credit Trump, if nothing else at this point, with having inspired the launch of a new women's movement in this country. So perhaps that's one of the things that the sort of, you know, the sentiment will amount to in the longer term. And there's evidence already that that's beginning to happen on the ground.
So another huge theme at our march was defense of reproductive rights, particularly Planned Parenthood and abortion rights. And the erosion of access to abortion has reached a critical point for many women, and the election of Donald Trump seems to crystallize and inspire this resistance. What's your take, Sherry Wolf?
Well, I mean, look, yesterday was the 44th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Today, Trump went ahead and signed what other presidents before him, Reagan and, of course, Bush, had signed, the global gag order that does not allow agencies that receive federal funding to even mention, no less offer, you know, just simply educate women. I mean, imagine that there could be such a thing as legislation against educating women about their health care options. It's an obscenity and an absurdity in itself. But there you have it. And I think that we are, you know, that's just that it's just the beginnings of a further chiseling away at our rights, because they know they can't completely obliterate it all. I mean, even, you know, there's only maybe 10 or 11% support in this entire country for getting rid of abortion wholesale. 50% of the country is totally for it, no matter what, and full access. And then there's, what, 25, 30% that will go with some degree of restrictions, which is bad enough, which has a history to it, including the Democratic Party having played a role in allowing and often championing these restrictions. So here we are at this point. I think what we're looking at is the absolute urgent need for a new women's movement to come forward, as we have in the past, and say, this is not on. This will mean death to women. This will certainly mean death to poor women, black women, young women, you know, who are going to effectively be denied access. What is the right to, what good is to have a formal right without any access? And that's what is happening here. It's a further erosion of access, which has been happening for decades now, that Trump is now, you know, taking to the next level. And we must fight him. We must.
So Trump and his followers claim a mandate for a boys will be boys attitude toward rape culture and a keep them barefoot and pregnant attitude towards women's rights to abortion. And many commentators put forward the message that America is turning to the right, embracing a backlash against feminism. What's your thinking about this, Sherry Wolf?
Well, I think Saturday was actually a rebuke to that notion. People should keep in mind always that 3/4 of the American adult population did not vote for Trump, right? If you add up the numbers that voted for Hillary, the numbers of people who didn't vote at all, of course, the numbers of people who voted for alternative candidates, Jill Stein, what have you, we're talking about 75% of the adult population in this country have not given a mandate to this. Anything that Trump stands for, anything that Trump professes to be for, and even half the population that didn't vote at all evidence points to the fact that they feel so disaffected by the inability of the Democrats to deliver any kind of progressive change, despite the much rosier, obviously, rhetoric that they have provided over the last years. And so you have this dynamic where the majority of the population defends women's right to choose or stands behind that. And what we're seeing is policy that is going smack against it. And we do well to study what the women of Poland recently did to accomplish their one-day strike that reversed bans on abortion in that country only a few months ago. I think actually a week before the election here in this country happened was when the strike happened in Poland of women that immediately within, 24 hours or 48 hours reversed that legislation. These are the kinds of tactics. These are the kinds of movements. These are the kinds of strategies and approaches and thinking that we need if we're going to defend the rights that we have from getting not just further whittled away, but win back and grab back what has already been taken. It's not sustainable. We're not going to be able to have a modern society where a huge swath of the population, you know, women in childbearing years just simply have zero control over their own bodies. This is not going to happen in the 21st century. We won't allow it. And I think those marches, that unprecedented turnout was an expression of that sentiment, at least, if it is still not yet organized. It's certainly in a sentiment.
So your thought is that we're not a nation that's moving to the right, despite the fact that we've got an extreme right-wing presidency, and by all accounts from the nominations for his cabinet and other positions, a rightward moving administration. There's a polarization going on within society, and the left is also growing.
Absolutely. Well, look, I mean, if anything, the middle has fallen out. What we have is enormous level of volatility and extreme polarization of political opinion. And, you know, I mean, I was there Friday, actually, which was markedly smaller than it was on Saturday by every scientific determination and just anybody who was there. And, you know, it gives you a sense of what is happening nationally. I mean, there's, you know, official politics has certainly moved harshly to the right But in terms of mass sentiment, in terms of where ordinary people are at, you know, it's interesting to me. We do need to explore why so many people in this country don't vote and don't see and didn't see any serious alternative or weren't inspired, however you want to read it, by Hillary Clinton. And the polls that I've seen, and there's a brilliant article that Kim Moody wrote, you know, kind of who put Trump in power, in which he shows how many people, working class people, black, white, brown, women, men, et cetera, are so disaffected by having been left out of any kind of economic advance, any kind of social advance over the last years, despite the most beautiful speeches we've heard at the top of, from the presidency, from Obama, you know, that those people poll well to the left of much of this country on race issues and on public policy. So I think it's important. We have to look at that reality. That people are unorganized in this country, but the sentiment is not against, single-payer universal health care. It's for it. And a lot of the complaints, for example, around Obamacare are not that it went too far and we must get rid of it, but that it didn't go far enough, that by keeping it entrenched in privatized insurance interests meant that for sure people's premiums would go up and there'd be no cap on drugs. And that's exactly what people feel is happening with this. And so now it's being attacked from the right. It's very difficult to summon the defense of it from the left because so little of it is defensible by many of the people who work in healthcare and actually have to use the plan. So you wind up in this conundrum. Of course, nobody wants to see, you know, healthcare taken away from people, but we also have to look at why is it that so many people hate this healthcare plan that was, you know, put forward, you know, the Obamacare Affordable, Care Act, that is very expensive, that entrenches privatized interests, and that applies the neoliberal model, the privatized everything model, to public health. You know, so these are some of the larger questions I think we need to ask, and that the protests on Saturday actually gave expression to.
Mm-hmm. So Trump has nominated Andrew Puzder for Secretary of Labor, the CEO of fast food chains like Carl's Jr., a man who has said in defense of Carl's Jr.'s sexist ads, I like beautiful women eating burgers in bikinis. I think it's very American. Sherry Wolf, what's the connection between the sexual objectification, the reproductive restrictions, and the low wages of women at fast food chains? I mean, I know that's a big mouthful to put out there, but there is connections here in looking at the picture of the incoming Trump administration.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems so, you know, so unremarkable given how atrocious Trump is that he would pick someone to be Secretary of Labor. I mean, somebody so contemptuous of labor. You know, of course the ads are disgusting and objectify women. I mean, what isn't sold without, you know, objectifying women's bodies at this point? Beer, cigarettes, you know, toilet paper, anything. What makes it that much more gross and noxious, I think, is exactly what you're saying, Jamie, is that the women, you know, in the restaurant industry are among the lowest paid. It's some of the lowest paid work you could possibly do, right? There's, 11 million restaurant workers in this country. A little bit more than half of them are women. And the people who are concentrated in the lowest paying jobs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, are precisely those jobs, women, mostly women of color, in the restaurant industry. So is it surprising that this man is a sort of sexist pig in terms of selling his burgers and yet treats the very people who are out there on the front lines of serving and putting together his product are so, you know, dramatically underpaid? You know, I was reading recently in New York City, and a minimum wage worker in New York City, which would be many of the people who work in the restaurant industry, fast food industry, women, would have to work something like 139 hours a week in order to afford a one-bedroom apartment in New York City. I mean, that's what we're looking at, you know, which is the ultimate act of, you know, disregarding women's lives, not even paying them enough to feed themselves and their children and pay the rent, you know, so no less offer them health care or anything else for that matter. So, Yeah, I'm not hardly surprised that his ads to peddle his miserable burgers, it's the only place I ever got food poisoning, by the way, was Carl's Jr. But the sexism he uses to peddle his miserable burgers, you know, is also hard at work in terms of, you know, the way he treats his own labor.
Do you see a, Sherry Wolf, do you see a connection between the assault on women's reproductive rights, restrictions on abortion, and the low wages of women in these fast in the labor force in general?
I guess I do. I think that it's the ultimate neoliberal logic. You know, you're on your own. You go figure it out. Suck it up. You know, both in terms of taking care of your health care and having any access to, you know, control of your own body, to being able to make wages that afford you a decent, you know, a decent living. I do see a connection. I think clearly the people who mobilized in record numbers on Saturday saw the connection as well, even if it's only at this point, you know, an untheorized connection. It's certainly there. People feel disrespected. People feel discarded. And women in particular, you know, it's almost, it's gobsmacking to hear that men who, you know, are, that a man like Trump, that a human being like that could be, that I can't even watch him. I mean, to be honest, I'm glad I don't have cable. It's so expensive and it's so miserable. I'm glad I don't have to watch him on TV every day. It would just be intolerable. But we do have to, you know, live under his policies, and we do have to deal with the fact that that person and those practices are now being normalized at the heights of American society. And that's not acceptable. That can't be acceptable. And clearly, a few million people on Saturday said it's not. And I think that's a great thing. That's a great start, at least.
If you've just, you're just tuning in, you're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is Labor Radio. Our guest is Sherry Wolf, a labor organizer and leading member of the International Socialist Organization. Sherry, in Oregon, the leadership of our the call for the Women's March, initially the Facebook call was a group of white women from outside Portland who were unaffiliated except as members of the National Organization for Women. And as thousands responded to their call on Facebook, a number of women of color and trans women demanded that issues addressed by the march include racism, transphobia, police violence, mass incarceration. And at the same time, the leadership of the D.C. Women's March issued this statement. The rhetoric of the past election cycle has insulted, demonized, and threatened many of us. Women, immigrants of all statuses, those with diverse religious faiths, particularly Muslim, people who identify as LGBTQIA, Native and Indigenous people, Black and brown people, people with disabilities, and the economically impoverished and survivors of sexual assault. So, Sherry Wolf, what is the significance of this struggle for an inclusive and intersectional women's movement?
I think it's very promising to me that there has been, from the moment it was raised, to my knowledge, let's remember, it was an informal kind of Facebook conversation among women, my understanding, white women, that other people, you know, that began to be broadcasted more broadly. And once the issues of inclusivity and multiracialism, and including other voices and people of other experiences, was raised, to my knowledge, it has never been a debate. It has always been, you know, embraced. And I think that the leadership that, you know, Carmen Perez and Linda Sarsour and others who came to the fore and began to pull things together, once it grew from tens of thousands into well over 100,000, and obviously, as the day showed, millions, people saw the need for inclusivity, although I'm sure that there were debates and that were uncomfortable in many places. But that's precisely what needs to happen in the building of any sort of mass struggle. But from what I can see in D.C., you know, there were, I'll give you an example. When I was waiting online, they were literally trying to, on the, you know, on the Friday, move us through an eyedropper through the security checkpoints to go to the parade route to protest Trump when he passed. And people, large crowds of white protests, although we're raising Black Lives Matter against the Trump protesters, the next day, a lot of the chants that had been learned on the days before, you know, thousand strong, you know, lines of, you know, no hate, no fear, immigrants are welcome here, were taken up and, you know, sort of broadcast throughout the various pockets of people who are clearly new to protesting on the Saturday. It's like people are looking for ways to connect to each other, you know, and it's not automatic, of course, but the instinct is towards solidarity. I see it in my own union. I mean, people were thrilled to be able to take a position demanding sanctuary, you know, at our campus. Professors, actually, we sided with the students who walked out in November. And, you know, there were maybe 2,000, 2,500 students and faculty and others who walked out demanding that the campus become a sanctuary campus. There is this sentiment, this understanding that we're all under attack right now. And we're all facing this sort of like freight train coming at us. And we all either kind of link arms and come together and create a wall against it, a united front, or we're going to get slammed. And I don't pretend that that's not going to mean that in the coming weeks and months, we're going to have many difficult conversations and debates and eye-opening, you know, revelations among people who are unfamiliar with, you know, the histories of various oppressions or the interlockingness of these oppressions. But it is real, and the conversation is in motion, and that's a good thing. You know, let's face it. I mean, if they go after Medicaid, if they go after Social Security, if they go after health care, it's going to require a multiracial, you know, fight back in this country. And people are going to have to get used to maybe having some arguments and discussions and being enlightened about things they might not have thought about before and being patient with each other. I believe the left needs to be very patient in building a broad front with folks who are hearing discussions and being part of organizing for the very first time. We have to. We live in a society that's very that doesn't educate us about our different oppressions, no less our own oppressions. It would be well worth us, you know, taking the time to be patient with each other in a world that is so crassly impatient with all of us.
Sherry Wolf, you've been an organizer and a labor organizer for decades. What type of organizing will it take to build a movement that's broad and deep enough to win the real progress toward women's liberation?
I think we need we certainly need unions, but we need well beyond you. I mean, you know, unions are what, 11% of public sector workers in this country are unionized, 6% something of private sector workers. Obviously, they will be and need to be a part of it. And I'm glad that many unions did come on board on Saturday and were effectively pushed by their own rank and file, who were ahead of many of the union leaderships in wanting to mobilize. But I think it's going to take all sorts of actions. I think teach-ins, I think direct action, I think civil disobedience, I think strikes, I think us getting our heads around what worked strategically in the past. I think people even beginning to have a conversation about what is strategy, what are tactics. I think sometimes there is a rushing ahead among the people who are already politically active and knowledgeable to be impatient with trying to build the numbers and the solidarity around them so that we can actually win. Because obviously we want to have not just mass symbolic protests, but we are going to have targeted actions that literally stop the wheels of production, stop the beast from being able to move forward. And that's going to take a lot of creativity, you know, and numbers. And we are not there yet. And organizing, because Saturday, so far as I can tell, is the big sort of everybody out. And now the question is, what is it going to look like in between? And so organizing meetings, I'm glad in my neighborhood there's now the beginnings of a social justice committee that's come about, that started with a march, you know, against, you know, Islamophobia and racism in my neighborhood. I happen to be a neighbor of, you know, Linda Sarsour, and there's a large Arab and Muslim community here. Linda is one of the, you know, leaders of the Women's March, one of the co-chairs, who is now actually being attacked by horrible Islamophobes, you know, and needs to be defended. I think that, you know, who are claiming that she's, you know, trying to bring us back to Sharia law, whatever, who cares? It's stupid, racist nonsense. The woman is a social democrat. I think that, you know, and an ally and an activist and should be defended. I think that we are looking at having to debate out what kinds of organizations are needed. I'm a socialist. I believe that people need to be organized as socialists, that that's the most effective way that you can be organized. But I think that people most definitely, no matter what, must be organized with a set of ideas, a set of history, and a means of democratically holding each other accountable to taking collective action and assessing our actions and figuring out how we can move forward. You know, if we're going to stop, you know, raids on immigrants, how are we going to do that? We've done that in certain points in history. How do we learn from those moments of having networks of people that will really stop those raids, set up genuine, effective sanctuaries? What will that look like? How do we stop a Muslim registry? How do we, you know, stop the watch lists and the McCarthyite attacks going on university campuses and in schools across this country? How do we stop the attacks on black people that never ended and always ratchet up when critters like Trump are in power? So I think that these are, you know, it's not a simple question, but there's lots of examples of what could work. So even just last weekend in Montana, activists came together and managed to stop what was going to be an armed white nationalist protest in a small town, Whitefish, Montana, you know, openly anti-Semitic, you know, in a state where it is legal to carry arms. And activists came together, many of whom had never done something like this before, and frankly got them to cancel before they even went ahead with it, because they saw that they were going to be massively opposed.
Thank you, Sherry. You mentioned, as a labor organizer, that you're also a socialist, and we only have a few minutes left. I'm going to ask you for the elevator speech. Your view is that the struggle for women's liberation must be tied to the labor movement and to fighting the capitalist system itself. Can you say a few words about that?
It's very simple, sure. I just think that the people who, you know, produce all the wealth in society, who make the subways run and who teach the kids and pick up the garbage and serve the meals at McDonald's and Starbucks ought to be involved in democratically controlling the wealth of that society and the way and decisions are made. I believe in workers' power. That's what it is. That's really ultimately what it is, about direct democracy, about ordinary people controlling society, and society running not on the basis of profit but on human need. And I think it's not only necessary but possible, but it will not happen and cannot happen unless people are organizing with a plan to make that happen. And that's why I organize as a socialist with the International Socialist Organization, affiliated with the Socialist Worker newspaper and socialistworker.org. And that's what I'm for.
Well, you've just answered my last question to a certain degree. I was going to ask you how our listeners can get more information and get involved. If you have any other words about the way forward for women's liberation, how people could or should be hooking up, looking forward.
Yeah. I mean, quite simply, if we're going to have the solidarity, the organization, and the struggle that we need in order to move forward, we need political ideas that are clear. So Haymarket Books has some of the best books. Kiangi Yamada Taylor's From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation is an absolute must-read text for anybody serious about making change in the world today. I think people should be reading socialistworker.org on weekdays. Labor Notes is a great labor read as well. Frankly, I think International Socialist Review, Journal, all of these things obviously online. And frankly, there ain't nothing like going to an actual meeting, sitting down in real time, having conversations and discussions and comradely debates in meetings. And that's it. International Socialist Organization does in branches throughout the country in many, many states and cities, including the one where you live in Portland.
Sherry Wolf, thank you so much for being with us this evening. You've been listening to labor organizer and socialist Sherry Wolf talk about the Women's March on Washington and the fight ahead for women's liberation. That wraps it up for Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. I want to thank our engineer, Danielle Parks, and stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for our Youth of Color Production Internship Program. This internship is open to people of color attending college and or under the age of 30. This is a 6-month internship for 20 hours a week for $20 an hour. Responsibilities include the selection and preparation of KBOO content for national distribution using a variety of digital audio workstations and helping to develop a digital content strategy for promotion of KBOO content. Deadline to apply is Friday, January 27th at 5 p.m. More information, including skills and qualifications, can be found at kboo.fm/productionintern2017.
Good morning, honey, you old gloomy sight. Good morning.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Lady Sings the Blues, showing Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. Diana Ross portrays jazz singer Billie Holiday in this biographical drama. The film depicts her early attempts at a singing career and her eventual rise to stardom, as well as her difficult relationships and drug addiction. Again, that's Lady Sings the Blues, Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad,